You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. A recent mass leak of financial documents from offshore law firm Applebee's, branded the Paradise Papers, has led to many people calling for the government to take decisive action against tax avoidance. Today we're joined by the IEA's Research Director, Dr. Jamie White, and Head of Financial Services, Diego Zuluaga. Interviewed by Kate Andrews, the pair discuss the fallout from the Paradise Papers and whether it's moral to minimise one's tax burden using offshore and other structures. Finally, they explore the role offshore funds will play in an increasingly globalised world. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
Diego, can you give us an update on the Paradise Papers and explain what's caused all this outrage?
So the Paradise Papers refers to a series of revelations coming from confidential documents that were leaked to a German newspaper and then were diffused around the media world by a series of outlets, including the BBC and The Guardian. And they refer to the financial dealings of people in tropical islands that have regimes that enable the creation of vehicles and financial instruments in a way that is deemed by some to be controversial, but it happens to be entirely legal. The reason they have become controversial is that a lot of names familiar to the public are associated with them. So the Queen of England was famously mentioned as one of the people who might potentially have had some of her estate placed in Bermuda. Now it seems that Prince Charles made some investments through offshore vehicles that then were associated with political initiatives or political decisions for which Prince Charles lobbied. A number of other prominent sports people, such as Lewis Hamilton and, you know, people from the business world, have been mentioned as part of these documents. I should say that this is a leak from a law firm called Applebee, which does dealings in a lot of these offshore centres, which are popularly sometimes referred to as tax havens. As far as I am concerned, the two terms are interchangeable. But the main characteristic of these types of arrangements is that they facilitate the movement of capital and they make it easier for people to reduce their tax bill, entirely legally, I should add, following the letter of the law in whichever countries they are doing business in.
The way that tax havens are reported on in the UK, at least, suggests that the whole purpose of them is to hide your money from the UK government, that this avoidance is incredibly questionable, if not illegal. So is there a misunderstanding of tax havens?
I would say there is. Tax avoidance is a behavior that we all engage in one form or another. So when we save money through an ISA, whose returns are exempt from tax up to a limit of savings, we are avoiding tax. When we buy duty-free cigarettes on holiday in Italy or in Spain because they're cheaper there, we're also avoiding tax. And higher income people, of course, have bigger means and they are usually better informed about ways to reduce their tax bill. And they are the most assiduous users of offshore centers in this type of way. But it is human nature. It is in the nature of economic interest to try and reduce your tax obligations. And if we wish for people to do it less, we should change legislation and enact policy reforms that try to mitigate these behaviors. But we should also be aware of the potential costs of it in the form of people not being able to allocate their capital in an efficient way, in the form of people not being able to save as they would like to, and in the form of economies perhaps becoming more isolated from the rest of the world.
So, Jamie, why has this debate about tax havens got so many people riled up?
Well, before I answer that, I want to clarify one thing. You don't hide your money in these places. There's been a lot of regulation recently, international agreement on cooperating between tax authorities so that if you put your money somewhere in Bermuda and you're a British citizen, the British tax authorities are informed of that. So it's not hidden. It's reducing your tax bill, but it is not being done in secret in that way, not at least from the authorities. To your question, I think some funny ideas are emerging about tax. It used to be the idea that the tax collector was one of the worst people in society. I mean, in the Bible, you know, tax collectors are bad guys. And I think one of the reasons is that a tax collector used to come to your house with a sword and threaten you if you wouldn't hand over the money. So it was very clear that it was a violent act against you, somebody confiscating your property. Now, there are two things that have changed. One is ideological, but the first one is the visibility of the violence. Most people pay tax directly. They don't ever see their gross income. They get their net income. Their employer sends the taxed part of the income directly to the tax authorities. And so the taxation and the threat of imprisonment if you don't pay it is kind of invisible. It's not made apparent to you. There's no man with a sword there. So the inherent violence in it is less apparent. Also, there seems to be an idea blowing around, particularly on the left, that really all money, or all income and all money, is really the state's, not yours. And they allow you to keep some of it, or not keep it, because it wasn't yours in the first place. They allocate some of it to you. This idea is implicit when tax cuts are described as gifts to the people who receive them. There's no gift involved. If you thought it was your money, there's no gift involved. But you can see that all the language around taxation has this implicit idea that the money is the government's in the first place. I'll give you a concrete example. Yesterday I was on Sky News. Not the left-winger I was up against, but the Sky journalist said, these people are terribly rich. Don't you think it's right that they give something back? Give back? I said, no, why are you saying give back? They didn't get their money from the state. But just by putting it that way, she assumed that they did. So I think these are the ideas that are driving this funny reaction to people doing what Diego said is perfectly natural, trying to keep hold of as much of their money as they can.
One of the phrases I've seen the past few days is that tax avoidance is theft, this idea that it did belong to the state and that you have somehow taken it by keeping it. Is one of the problems, though, in this debate that the people who are usually able to use a tax haven are wealthy? They tend to be wealthy. And there is a worry that only a certain group of people can access them, even if it's legal.
There are two things that drive that fact. One is that the natural fact that if you've got a lot of money at stake, it's worth your while to put in the effort to spend the money to reduce your tax bill, to hire the lawyers who will arrange affairs for you and so on. If we're talking about saving £100, it's not worth it. But if we're talking about saving £1,000, it is worth it. So there's that factor. And I don't think that's problematic. That's just the normal economics of the situation. However, certain kinds of tax systems encourage this much more than others. And in particular, taxing income encourages it. The profits of companies and the incomes of individuals. If taxation, for example, I'll give you an alternative, were based on, let's say, consumption, so you had sales taxes, and land, for example. So if you raised most of the tax revenue in those two ways, you wouldn't see nearly as much of this behavior. So I think it's an artifact, an unavoidable artifact of the economics of the situation and of the structure of our tax system.
Can I come in on that? Because one important thing that people need to remember is that the phenomena of tax havens or offshore centers really only emerged in the post-war period, so after World War II, because this was a time when the world had begun to globalize in the 19th century and the world had become wealthier. There were excess funds to be invested and deployed around the world. And then from about the time of the end of World War I and the Great Depression, there was a great nationalization of economic policy, meaning that barriers went up and capital mobility declined, trade declined quite significantly. This continued in the early years of the post-war period. And that meant that in order to avoid double taxation, and we have to remember that at this time taxation was around the developed world prohibitively high, people allocated their capital to these kinds of places in a bid to try and reduce the potential for double taxation. So as Jamie points out, this is just an emergent phenomenon trying to address the very large fiscal pressures on certain people during a particular time period. And of course, the capital that was allocated, deployed in these places, didn't stay there. It was then invested in ventures around the world. It was dedicated to creating productive activity and employment in different places. And the idea was that whatever returns could be secured from that wouldn't be subject to punitive taxation and could provide an adequate return to the owners.
And Diego, something that you're starting to point out there is the role of globalization in all of this. Is it reasonable to expect that in an increasingly global world that we're not going to have tax havens? As it becomes easier to move yourself around the world, to move goods and services around the world, surely money's going to go with that too.
I believe the role of tax havens, offshore centers, will become greater for the next few years, simply because what we see right now is that the rich world, what we see as the rich world, mainly North America and Europe, is saving less and less and becoming less and less of the world capital pie. And savings are coming more and more from developing countries, which is great news because, first of all, it's an indication that these places are becoming richer, rich enough to have excess funds above subsistence level. But then secondly, it's good because it means that these people will now form part of the global investment pool, which is one of the reasons why interest rates are reasonably low. But the point as far as tax havens goes is that they will probably play a more prominent role because a lot of these countries still don't have very strong rule of law. and they don't have legal and tax regimes that are adequate by the standards of a developed country. And a tax haven can help in that regard because they often have English common law as the prevailing legal system. They have a contract law system that is reliable and strong and can be enforced. And so if you are from one country investing in a third country with which you have relatively little familiarity, or you're making a deal with someone from a third country, it does make sense to come to a neutral place that you know, that you can rely on, whose legal system you understand, and where the tax law is reasonably favorable, so that you can go into these deals with the assurance that you won't be expropriated, that you won't be subject to tax that you didn't envisage, and that you can have fairly transparent handling of any sort of legal conflicts that might arise.
Yeah, I really want to back that up. I mean, generalize the point. These tax havens are typically very small countries where their economy is largely dependent on their offshore banking services and the tax rates that they use. They are trying to attract willing customers, so they have to operate in a way which is very transparent, very reliable, and so on. Otherwise, people won't put their money there. The places from which the money is coming are the opposite. They are trying to confiscate money from people who don't want to give their money away, and they progressively, interestingly, start acting in the opposite way from tax havens. They undermine the rule of law, and this recently happened in the United Kingdom when, I think it was in 2009, they introduced the general anti-avoidance rule. This is a rule which, roughly speaking, says you may have obeyed the letter of law in taxation, but we have the right, as the tax authorities, to deem you to have not obeyed with the spirit of the law or have to entered into these arrangements merely for the purpose of reducing your tax bills, and therefore we're going to charge you more tax, take more tax from you, than you are strictly legally liable for. So you see the different incentives of the different kinds of regimes. One who is dealing with people on a voluntary basis has to be clear, transparent, rule of law. The other one, in a desperate bid to confiscate funds for whatever reasons it has, usually political, starts to undermine the rule of law, starts to become predatory.
Jamie, is one of the reasons that the tax haven debate has become such a hot topic at the moment because Western countries are truly running out of money?
I guess so. I hadn't really thought about that, but that's probably right. I mean, if you look at the UK's history, almost never, it doesn't really matter what tax rates are, what kind of system we have, no government's really managed in the 20th century and beyond to pull in more than about 40% of GDP. Just seems to be some kind of upper limit. They can't do it. But of course, they spend more than 40% of GDP. So they've got a little bit of a problem here. They don't want to face up to it because, of course, you know, there are many interests that they serve by doling out that money. So you may well be right that this is one of the reasons. I think the other reason, and it comes back to this question about why there's such a moral fuss about this, is that nowadays people see the state as the vehicle for the compassionate society. If we need something, it must be delivered by the state. If you want better healthcare, if you want better education, that means the government needs more money. As those education and health, for example, have become bigger portions of our total spending, this drives up the need for government revenue. And I think we have got ourselves absolutely in a terrible spot here, where there's a complete tension between, on the one hand, what the government can raise in revenue, and on the other hand, what are the popular demands for government spending. It's got to break. It's impossible. And a lot of governments now are agreeing they want tax harmonization all around the world. They want tax harmonization in Europe. Why is this? It's an attempt to stop the money running away. We, of course, like tax competition. It holds tax rates lower, but that's the last thing they want. And there have been lots of measures to try to shut down tax havens. America has become extremely aggressive about it. Though Diego said they're going to have a bigger role to play, that's right on the demand side. I think without a doubt there'll be a greater demand for it. However, the powerful governments around the world are really trying to shut it down on the supply side.
Well, I know as an American and as an expat that America is one of the only countries in the world that tries to tax its citizens on the income that they earn outside of the country, which is so draconian.
One of the common misconceptions, I think, coming from the media, which influences the public, is that the options are either that these people who now use offshore centers will pay more tax on the economic activity that they conduct, or that the status quo will carry on as it is. It is much more likely, however, I believe, that you will end up with less economic activity if you try to restrict capital mobility, and if you make it more difficult for people to conduct economic activity in a way that they can capture most of the return. The question that people need to ask themselves is the following: would you rather have someone work or invest their money and not pay tax on the return on that investment, or if you restrict the mobility of capital, or if you raise marginal tax rates to the point where it's no longer worthwhile for them to work, that they don't conduct any of that economic activity. Obviously, the first option is much more attractive because you actually have economic activity going on and you have a return that results from that, and that benefits society as a whole.
What should tax policy be? What should we be trying to accumulate from people's income and from people's wealth? Because it feels like this debate around tax havens suggests that it's much more than just being able to pay for what government does. It is, as Jamie said, this idea that the government is this benevolent figure and that it is almost like a mandatory charity exercise. Is that the right way to be looking at tax policy?
What I would say is that once we've agreed on what government should do, there are two points on which we really shouldn't disagree. And if we do disagree, then there is a problem. The first point being that taxation should be as efficient as possible, meaning that it should distort behavior the least possible, and it should raise the greatest amount for the lowest amount of pain for the people paying the tax, meaning that it should be predictable, that it should be progressive, that it should lead to the most efficient allocation of resources. And the second being that we want to encourage economic activity. We don't use tax policy to punish successful people. We use tax policy as a way to capture in the least distortive way as many resources as we need to finance the public services that we wish to provide.
I agree with you entirely. You want the most efficient way of raising this, the money needed for the government to spend. But you and I are out of sync with the population here, because there was an interesting survey done a few years ago and people were asked, if a tax raised no revenue for the government, increasing a tax rate, like the top rate of income tax, would you nevertheless be in favor of it for moral reasons? And more than 50% of the population, I think it was 59, said yes, they would. So they wanted it merely for punitive purposes, and they thought that that punitive purpose was moral. So people earning high incomes should be punished for earning high incomes. It was such a perverse view. It's nasty. It's wrong-headed economically, but that's where the population currently is. There's this strange idea, and it gets back to what you were saying about economic activity, that private actors in an economy are harming people, and the only good they do is by paying tax, transferring the money to the government, who then use it well. In the process of making that money, they're actually attacking the population, and they need to be stopped and prohibited and punished. There's a profoundly anti-capitalist mindset that's taken on, and you can see it in the language used and the way people vote on these polls. And it's our job to somehow correct them.
Jamie, is one of the problems with tax that it teaches people wrongly that economic flourishing is a zero-sum game, this idea that I have to take from one to give to the other? But actually, as Diego's been pointing out, if you're investing in the economy in an appropriate and useful way, many people can benefit from that.
Right. I think zero-sum thinking is behind many of the problems we now have. So if you had a zero-sum view of the world and you observe somebody getting rich, well, that must be at the cost of other people. So then it makes sense to say that we can take some of that back. You've taken off us, we'll take some of that back. That's the implicit idea. It's so obviously false that it's hard to explain. I mean, how is it possible that global living standards keep improving if economics is a zero-sum game? Yet that is the kind of thinking that's in people's heads. I think that a lot of the thinking in people's heads starts when they're children, obviously. And your first experience of economics is in the family. And in the family, you're a child and you are given things that you didn't produce. And your experience is purely allocative. What share am I getting of the stuff that's in the house? You play no role in production. And I think that this economic worldview, so to speak, lives on in people even long into adulthood. And we've somehow got to kick it out of people. But all the language, unfortunately, all the language, like giving back and so on, it all kind of reinforces it.
And we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which more and more knowledge about the economic effects of certain types of taxation has improved outcomes around the world. It used to be the case, not that long ago, in the 19th century, that most government revenues were derived from taxes at borders, so customs. That obviously sharply diminished incentives for economic activity and trade. It made economic exchange less of a win-win activity, because the movement of resources meant that a particular customs office would have less revenue to derive potentially for some period of time. But that periodically changed, partly because states became bigger, but also because as we started to trade, we realized the benefits that could be had from it, and policy changed as a result. And more recently, we used to rely much more on direct taxation, so the taxation primarily of income for individuals and income for corporations. And over time, we've realized, as Jamie was briefly pointing out earlier, that indirect taxation, so taxation of consumption, is more efficient because it leads people to change their behavior less. And we want people to change their behavior less because if they don't change their behavior, it means they're doing whatever's in their economic interest, and whatever's in their economic interest tends to be the most productive, and that tends to have the greatest benefits for society. Now, the progressive understanding that we have had of these issues has meant that we can get bigger bang for our buck. It's part of the reason why, with declining tax rates, we have higher revenues. Corporations are paying now more as a share of all taxation and as a share of GDP than they were in 1980. Very few people would assume this fact, but if you look at OECD data, it is the case. And it is the case across a range of rich countries, right? Including the United Kingdom. And so we must question a lot of the previously existing assumptions that people have. And perhaps I am slightly more sanguine than Jamie when I hear reports of people saying that it's morally right to confiscate from people, even if that hurts all of us, because I think a lot of people just simply are not exposed to the economic arguments involved in this. And perhaps, you know, it is their first instinct to assume that it should be the case that people should pay back more.
Or that it wouldn't really be the case that it wouldn't benefit them. That, mm-hmm. you know, if more money is there to be taken, wouldn't really be the case that it couldn't be, even though we know, as Jamie pointed out, that it's very difficult to get that revenue in the door for the government. So, Jamie, what do you say to those fundamentally who think that it is immoral to avoid tax in some capacity?
Well, when you avoid tax, you pay your legal tax requirement. So if you're people are saying it's immoral for you not to pay more, they want you to donate money to the government. That's what they're suggesting.
Which very few people do.
Nobody does that. I think in the UK, the latest figure was that 5 people did it and 4 of them were dead.
Legacy gifts.
When people donate their money, they tend to donate it to some particular cause that they believe in or to their family or to whatever. But I think there's a really alarming idea here. When I was on the radio, on TV yesterday, the woman said to me that these rich people had more than they needed, and so they should pay more tax. Now, there's an idea implicit in all this, which is that you really have a moral duty to hand over to the state whatever you don't need. And that is a weird idea, and it leads to where some socialists got, which is that you're really just a servant of the state or of the entire population. It's a vision of life and of humanity, which is that we are each other's servants and not individuals pursuing our own goals. And I find it alarming, and it could lead to really crazy things. I mean, suppose you took early retirement. You're withholding tax from the state. You could still be working. Why aren't you working? Or you're putting yourself ahead of your fellow man. Why don't we ban early retirement? The logic is exactly the same. It's that we are getting a collectivist morality. And I've never seen any society where there was a dominant collectivist morality which didn't descend into poverty and brutality.
Diego, do you have a slightly more optimistic view?
Well, I think one important thing to remember is that people are greedy. And yes, of course, they will try to do whatever is most beneficial to them. But governments are greedy, too. And the reason we like tax competition is not because it facilitates individual people's greed, but because it minimizes the potential for governments to confiscate people's wealth and income. In fact, one of the things that the British press really highlighted a couple of years ago was the massive movement of French entrepreneurs and French financiers to London as a result of the very high 75%, I think it was, top tax rate that François Hollande temporarily introduced. We like that because it is an indication that people are free and people are doing whatever is most in their interest of themselves individually, of course, but also in their family's interest and productive to the economy. And it tends to lead to greater efficiency in government because that means that whatever revenues governments get have to be spent more wisely rather than on whatever programs governments set up. Just to conclude, there was a US Supreme Court justice who I believe in the 1930s, or maybe earlier even, said that taxes are the price we pay for living in a civilized society.
Wendell
and
Holmes.
I would sort of modify that or paraphrase that to say that tax avoidance is the price we pay for living in a free and competitive society in which we have the ability to make our own decisions and improve our conditions and those of our fellow men.
be sure to check out more podcasts, blogs, research and film at our website, iea.org.uk.